7th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit what? What is it? You were staring, I mean, I'm not like the kind of guy who says this, but you were staring directly at my crotch and sneering.
So Caleb,
what are you doing? Sitting on the, I was bouncing on the ball?
Yeah, but you didn't start bouncing until you started the intro.
Why, but you're even if that's true, why were you staring at my, like, middle zone?
Because that's where the moving is happening, and you just started that
where a
weird,
person
uncomfortable
bounces.
Bouncing. And, but you were still until you started recording.
You don't understand anything about what, like, you take on a certain physicality
it.
Is not a part of this show. It's like whatever it takes to get your voice in the right space.
It's
you're
gross.
Still I'm not even bouncing anymore. You're still staring at my nuts.
I'm waiting for you
and
to
I'm like I hate it. That's what I'm talking. I hate that I'm like ugh, nuts guy. Don't look at my balls, dude. Like
no.
That's not what this
that's
show
what
is
this podcast
to be about.
Is a lot of is fucking
not
hidden dicks and nut jokes. And I'm so sad
not
we
a
came
joke.
To that.
It's not a joke. This isn't a joke.
I wasn't going to talk about your dick. You're talking about your own dick, bro.
Because you were just glaring at
I'm
it.
I'm still doing it.
We have a guest.
Where we revisit classic movies.
It's great. First of all, it's great. It's been 67 episodes of great movies, not classic.
Classic movies from the 80s and 90s.
My name is Kalen
Egan. Might suck. My name is Travis Sintel.
And we have my good pal, Spencer Owen.
Hi.
In the studio.
I could be your friend, too.
Well, he's not your good pal.
No, but we
just
could
admit
be.
That much. Okay, call him whatever you want.
There are tiers. There is a hierarchy.
Yeah.
We must establish this.
No, you're a top tier friend for Kalen. You're a lower tier friend for me. But you're climbing up the ranks fast. So let's just let it be what it is. Don't label shit.
I feel like I'm on an escalator right now. I feel like I'm rising slowly.
You're rising up to Team Travis.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Spencer.
Yeah.
We decided to start you. I haven't seen you in a very long time, and I'm not even sure how long. It might be a year.
It might be.
Could it be more than a year?
It could be more than a year. I haven't seen you since you became a legitimate father.
Oh, well, then it's a year. It's like 20 months or something.
Yeah, it's been a while.
My life is measured in months.
When did you play that basement show thing we went to?
Oh, that was hell of a
That was a while ago.
I really lose track of time.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's great to see you, man.
I'm so happy to be here.
We'll just do a friend catch up after.
Yeah, we'll probably catch up a little later.
But here's what I wanted. So, I think about this every time. This time I'm really going to do it. I want to be a good host to our guest. And we never are.
No.
We always sort of blow through the intros or whatever.
I don't know. I mean, like, I wanted to be here, so clearly you're doing something sort of right.
Yeah,
like,
well, that's cool.
It doesn't sound like you're torturing or punishing anyone.
No, I think we have great.
There's
guests. We have great guests, and it's awesome. I just always feel like we fail miserably at the sort of traditional host part of it, and I just want to do. I want to do that. I'm going to do that right. We're going to do it right.
I want to.
And I will say what my sort of history is with Spencer. Then I have some even deeper bio questions I want to ask you.
Okay.
So I knew Spencer. I met Spencer. Actually, as his, I want to say like TA or something, or like class assistant in college.
Yeah, basically, at UC Santa Cruz, there was this kind of class you could take called a core class. Every freshman was required to take this, and we both lived in the same part of the college, the same college as they called it. So we got thrown together. I think I met him on like our first.
Well, it was
or second day of college.
Yeah, it was my sophomore year, and it was Spencer's freshman year. So I'd been through this thing, and I got enlisted to. I asked, or somebody asked me to do this sort of teacher's assistant role.
Enlisted,
whatever. And I was, you know, unprepared for that. But what was really fun about meeting Spencer is that I was just sort of like, who's this guy who I keep letting derail the class with Werner Herzog impressions? and I was like, oh, I'll just be that guy's friend.
I can honestly say I don't remember that. Here's what I can say. Do I remember constantly doing Werner Herzog impressions? Of course I remember that. Do I remember doing it in class? No, I do not.
Oh, you did. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here right now.
But you clearly invited this on some level. Like,
well, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
It came up. I just didn't expect someone to take the bait quite so hard. And it was awesome. So then, you know, I'm sorry to everybody else who might have been in that class.
Yes. I also am sorry.
but
not listening
what I,
right now.
But what I also... And I've known Spencer... So that means I've known you for... you know, 10 plus years, you know, over a decade.
Oh, God, 15.
Well, over 15
almost
years.
Almost 15 years.
That's crazy,
yeah.
Man. What I found out very quickly, and what is still true, is that Spencer is perhaps the most talented musician I know.
Yeah, he rules.
And so that I said perhaps.
Yes,
no, but
I
still
think. But I think it's. I think it's a. I could argue that point with myself. Very.
I'm not going to rank you convincingly in terms of musicians I know. It's weird and not worth our
top
time.
Top tier musicians I know.
I really, yes. I think the hierarchy concept is really, it's a home run. I think we should keep nailing that.
Yeah. We'll see one how thing you come good. Out yeah. on the other side of this show. Are you still my favorite musician, friend?
With a bullet.
But the Herzog thing is important in that Spencer also has a deep, deep film knowledge. And what I wanted to ask Spencer, and what I think we should ask all guests, basically, is what is your relationship to film? And like, as you grew up, and as this is a podcast about nostalgia, you know, do you have kind of a way to talk about that very briefly?
I can. So I think my relationship to film is actually similar to my relationship to music, which is my first love. There's like kind of two parallel, I kind of envision two parallel tracks. One where I'm like, you know, a dumb kid just checking out whatever and being like, this is great or fine. One or the other.
Right.
And,
which is, it's everything's,
it's either great or fine. Either great.
That is the baseline. Yeah. Up until you're like 12.
It's a total binary, greatness or fineness. And then there's the other track of like stuff that was totally lighting me up and like pushing me into the future as a like a musician, or in this case as an appreciator of art and film,
right?
Visual art, whatever, performance, any, I kind of glom that all together as like things that, because I am a really big fan of experimental work. David Lynch is my favorite director, which makes this a really great summer for me so far.
But you're caught up, I assume.
I am completely caught up.
Woo,
I'm still doing the mantra in my brain. But you know, I also really like, you know, I just like, so for instance, to go back, the first movie I remember really having an impression on me is Koyaanisqatsi.
Wow.
Wow.
And I was a good child. And, okay, a lot, so my parents have a lot to do with this.
Yeah.
They just kind of figured it out. Like my favorite musician from youth was Laurie Anderson. And my mom kind of figured out that I would just appreciate that.
Right.
And she was completely right.
Did your parents do drugs and stuff?
My mom did in, you know, the 60s.
So they're like 70s. Part of that scene, at least tangentially.
Yeah, right. Sure. Right. But like, you know,
I don't think of Laurie Anderson or Koyaanisqatsi as drugs.
I think of Koyaanisqatsi as possibly.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it has that reputation and that cultural attachment. But I think that for me, Koyaanisqatsi, like, I remember it as a movie my parents really admire and talk about all the time, falling asleep through also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. But so like, you really appreciating anyway.
Young Spencer Owen, who sees this, what, 6, 7, 5?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You sit wrapped?
Wrapped.
That's wow.
Totally wrapped.
That is fascinating.
And the music and visual was a big part of it too, like the interplay.
Yeah.
To the point where my dad actually had this VCR where you could dub sound over visual that already existed on the thing. It was a crazy machine.
Wow.
It seemed like more, like seemed kind of like a slightly extra than consumer level VCR.
Yeah.
And so you could plug in audio, you know, RCA cables and hit a special record button and it would just dub sound over
but
the video. But keep the visual.
That's amazing.
Whoa.
And I had this beat up copy of Koyaanisqatsi because I just kept putting different soundtracks on top of it to see how it would match up over and over and over again. So that
I
was
didn't
like,
think it was possible, but you already are a more talented musician in my life.
Yeah, that's than good. I thought. That's really
like
good.
That origin story just elevated you.
I mean, I wasn't, it wasn't like a, it's possible I was recording music on top of it, but I was also dubbing other
soundtracks.
Right, right. Just albums I liked and stuff. And then through the years, like, you know, that ever, like, over the next like decade or something, it's like peppered with like, you know, going to see Problem Child 2 at a drive-in theater and like, you know, like I just remember things like that too. And like, cause I have the sort of nostalgia. I wasn't a Star Wars kid.
Right.
I wasn't an Indiana Jones kid. I wasn't really a Spielberg or a Lucas kid.
Is there a style
kid.
Of movies you gravitated towards?
Or
genre of film?
That's a good question. I can't say, like, as a child, I don't remember. As a teenager, like, 2001 started, like, it was another, like, lit up my world kind of movie. Right. And you know, and then in college, Godard just, like, blew me away. And stuff like that. So, like, I've just been trying to... I feel like I've been shirking my art film late. Like, I feel like I'm in my, you know, mid-30s, and so I'm kind of like, I'm missing. Like, there's got to be other stuff. Like, I just went and saw Wonder Woman, and it was great, but that's, like, one of the only movies I've seen this year. And I'm like, this feels wrong, because that's not how I've been over the last two decades of my life.
Right,
you know.
Well, it happens to the best of us, man. We stop, like, it's hard even, I mean, we talk about it all the time. I go to movies so much, I mean, I have a child, but I go to movies so much less.
Yeah.
Than ever in my entire life. And the fact that this is also the sort of dawning era of Netflix cinema is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that these things seem to be flowing together.
They do,
for a certain generation, a certain style of consumer. Anyway, let me ask you this. Out of all of that, as a way of transitioning into today's film, which Spencer does not yet know the title of.
Which is Godardian.
Let me ask you, actually, before I ask you that, before I tell you this, Spencer, before I ask you this question, you know the title, Travis.
Yeah, I do.
Knowing what you know of Spencer, you guys have only hung out a few times.
Yeah.
You may or may not have had a text exchange about a vacation.
quite possible.
We're still debating.
Allegedly, Spencer and I have exchanged texts. I'm not confident. He's not confident. Feels possible. That feels entirely possible.
Spencer has no recollection of this.
Yeah. Let's enjoy this.
But he also
doesn't
remember
this alternate reality. Yeah. Let's just let it float parallel universe style.
I think the ambiguity of our relationship is quite nice.
I think it's exciting. It's
good. I know that you have not seen this film.
That's correct. I have not seen this movie.
Do you think
let me say this to you. May have seen it in retrospect. I've been thinking about it, and it's a movie that has been quoted around me extensively. I will say that.
Whoa. Okay. Quoted. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we're building up clues.
I'm starting
to sort of say
things, but I'm going to say this to Kaylin as means of introduction and also possible cluing in. It's a movie that everyone around me certainly saw had seen multiple times.
Yeah.
I'm not confident I haven't seen it, but I think there's like a 15% chance I've seen it.
Here's what I think. Kind of think you'd know if you'd seen it.
Okay, well, I don't think I've seen it then.
Do you think Spencer's seen it?
Yes.
I'm zeroing in on 90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
So who are you? What are you seeing in 1996?
I will say this.
Oh, 1996.
Yeah, and means...
Titanic.
too early.
I didn't...
Oh, wait, what year is that?
1997.
Yeah, okay, 97. Titanic was a huge movie, by the way, for me. Because
really?
That was the first movie where I saw it once, and I loved it. And I saw it the second time, and I think I loved it more. And then I saw it the third time, and this was probably within a month.
Yeah.
All in the theaters. And I didn't like it.
Wow.
Weird.
Yeah.
Wow, weird.
And I think I was maybe influenced by some people in my life who were kind of like, oh, that dialogue is not good, is it? And I was kind of like, dialogue is not good, is it?
They put an earwig in your brain, and it screwed you.
They did. Oh. Like a bug that must be squashed quickly, or that's a line from the movie, and I remember thinking like my friend Josh, I think my best friend at the time, was like, "What a terrible line!" And I watched the movie again, and kind of the whole thing was colored by that, and I was like, "Wait, this isn't how people talk.
Yeah.
What is this movie?"
I think that a lot of people of our generation, that's a part of the evolution, man, especially for big budget sort of what you might consider popcorn entertainment or massively successful entertainment.
You got to go through that
rejection in order to get back to the love.
Completely. I got to tell you the movie I saw in 1996.
Okay. Mm.
Schizopolis.
Okay.
Okay. Different.
Well, you didn't. You didn't get it this time.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah, this is a problem.
Like in when I was 13, I had a complicated relationship with the movie Titanic.
Yeah.
When I was 12, I had an uncomplicated love for the movie Schizopolis.
Yeah.
And by the way, since then, I've probably seen it 15 more times. I still love it. It unfolds and unfolds. Yeah, the dialogue. Yeah. No, it unfolds and unfolds and unfolds for me.
Realistic, Spencer.
I still love this movie.
Will say two things then. One, this is a different genre.
No, I believe it.
Two, it falls in, if you've listened to our podcast, which I think you have.
I've listened to almost every episode.
That's amazing. Oh, Also, I want to get into, before I tell you the movie, any particular beefs you have. I like asking people that question. So mull on that while I tell you this. I do think if you know the podcast...
Know that we've already filled our balls quota of the day. Like, no talking
you
about
did.
Balls
I didn't,
conversation.
You talked a lot about balls.
For the record, not my scene.
Yeah. Well, there's one past guest and listener whose scene it is. Yeah. You're not going to name names, but we all know who the fuck we're talking about. Hidden.
He has two initials.
Yeah, that's right. So I will say that this film falls firmly in the genre that I would not have seen, I think.
Yeah. Sure. But, you know, here's the other clue, and I don't know if this is going to help or not, but it's something that I have to say by way of introduction. When we pulled it, and you'll hear it on the episode that is yet to air, but we recorded previously. Mm-hmm. I was not very excited.
He's been a stone cold bummer all day about this. He's been like, oh, I've got to go do this dumb movie.
That's
interesting. I'm so annoyed to watch this.
But I really mean this. I am about a zillion times more excited to watch it, knowing that Travis hasn't seen it. And because you're here, because I think this is going to be a complicated film for all of us. Ooh. For all sorts of reasons.
Okay.
And I'm ready to confront it with you guys.
I will say, I was stoked to watch it and excited until today when you started bumming on it all day. You bummed so
well,
hard
on
it.
I did that on the podcast.
I'd always dismiss that because sometimes your gut reaction, you sort of level out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was excited. It's a movie I think I haven't seen or whatever, right. And I was excited to see it. Anyway, let's get to what
yes.
it might
so
be.
So, if you have no guesses, I can give you more clues or I can just fucking tell you the movie.
If you want to give me one more clue.
One more clue.
I'm not very close to anything.
Can I just give the genre and you can give a better clue?
Sure.
I would say action.
Yeah, it's an action movie.
Action movie, 1996.
Yeah.
Oh.
We can narrow in if we have to.
Wait, maybe I don't. Okay.
Just take a guess if you have something.
Is the movie Last Action Hero from that year?
No, I think that's earlier.
Okay,
that
is
more
earlier.
Like 93-ish.
Because I've been thinking about rewatching that.
I'd love to watch that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the last clue I'll give you.
Okay.
The director of this film is notable.
Uh-huh.
And he is often compared to the director. Next year's favorite film.
That was a great
yes.
clue, man. Nice
Wait,
work.
My next year's favorite film?
Would be Titanic.
Oh, often compared to him.
Yes. He wants to be him.
Oh, weird. Oh, yeah. I don't know.
I know what the movie is,
I can't
and I'm
say
confused
I know.
By that clue.
Okay, yeah, that was a terrible clue. Here's the movie.
Okay.
It is called... here's a clue. Yeah, here's yeah, a clue. Yeah. Here's a clue.
Okay. Oh, I like what you're going.
It's officially
yeah.
oh. In the Criterion Collection.
Not what I thought he was going to
say. Oh! Is this a Michael Bay movie?
Yes, it is.
Holy shit. I probably have not seen this movie.
Okay.
Is it Con Air?
No, that's not even
that's
a Michael,
not a Michael
Bay,
Bay.
Movie.
What's the other one I'm thinking
it's
of?
It's the other one.
The one I'm getting mixed up.
Yep.
The Rock.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
Rock.
Have you seen it?
Nope.
Oh,
here we go.
Boy.
All right, so here's what I'm...
One and a half of us hasn't seen this movie.
This is really exciting for me because there's like these early movies like... Well, who did Con Air, first of all?
Oh, who knows? Simon West.
Okay, there's somebody. Just like these mid-90s action movies, yeah. like pre-Armageddon ones, that I just haven't seen.
Because mm-hmm.
when I was that age, I just wasn't watching those
yeah,
movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually almost sort of anti-violence in movies. I didn't want to see blood. I didn't want to see... Like, I just didn't really
just
like
Koi
it.
Just Koi and Ascazi.
Yeah, just Koi and Ascazi, yeah.
Some feel-good visuals.
Just industrial world-killing violence.
Right. Solid ones. Yeah.
Just meditations on the destruction of our planet.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is... The thing about The Rock is I would have been really no holds barred excited about it, except I watched it a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And when I watched it a couple years ago, I was like, fuck yeah, I get to watch The Rock. Like, here's the thing. I've always wanted to like Michael Bay movies.
Yeah,
because I think he's an idiosyncratic guy. I think he has a very distinct visual thing, as insane as it is. And so I was like, you know what? The best of these movies is probably The Rock. So I'm going to go fucking watch The Rock. And I watched it and I was like, eh. And so I'm trying to lower that expectation. I don't think I'm going to go fucking crazy.
You
for
may
it.
Have learned by doing that. That you think Michael Bay is not a good director.
but my
epiphany. For
I will him. Never stop wanting. I will never stop wanting to like the guy. And what I had a friend who worked for him with him. He did the DVD behind the scenes stuff of like Transformers 1 or something.
Yeah,
he's been on the shows. Charlie Lazarica. He was on one of our shows. And basically, the way that Charlie describes him is everything about the man that you hang out with, that you meet, is exactly one-to-one reflected on screen. He is one of the greatest, if you can call it, artists at transposing a personality onto screen.
Great.
He says it's exact. It's exactly that guy. Hmm. And I feel in my gut like that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. That does feel like. I mean, that does feel like consistent with. And I hate to mention this for fear of something happening, but yeah. Boondock Saints.
Yeah, yeah. I would have gone there if you didn't,
angle,
Spencer.
That feels very consistent with the Boondock Saints angle that you were presenting.
Yes. And it's something that I find fascinating. Now, the same thing about Boondock Saints is, what if you hate that guy?
Yeah, right.
Like, that makes it really hard to watch those movies. Like, as much as I want to respect and, like, get into the art of this guy who can do this thing.
And for the record, James Cameron is good at that, too.
Sure.
I mean, you may have a more complicated feeling about that than I do, because I've studied probably him way more than I have. Right. I've seen most of his movies, though, and I do like him.
Yeah.
And I feel like if James Cameron has sort of, like, tropes that you can just picture a guy behind them all,
right,
then
this is a silly thing to say, but one of those things that I think of when I think of James Cameron is great storyteller,
right?
And Michael Bay, that's not part of his personality.
Yeah.
And so that's hard for me, because I watch these movies and I'm like, I think I hate you. Yeah. And I don't like hating anybody. I'm not like a hater. So back off.
You are wearing a Miley Cyrus t-shirt right now.
And exactly. Really bouncing hard on the ball.
But you are not a hater.
No, not a hater.
I mean, I don't think I like Michael Bay. I've barely seen any of his work. Yeah. I saw Armageddon when it came out, oddly enough. Mm. I don't know why, but I did, and I had a totally confused reaction to it.
Yeah. Confusing. Yeah. He's confusing. That's how I feel about him. So as I revisit The Rock, I'm kind of excited for you guys to see it, because I want to know if we're beaten up by this movie or if there is some energy to be found.
Yeah.
Here's what I hope. The last fun, quote-unquote, popcorn movie we did, I would argue, is Die Hard 3, right?
Yeah. Die Hard with Vengeance, which I watched just before you guys did it. I kind of watched it in preparation for the podcast.
Super fun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, fun.
Really good.
It was fun. When we pulled The Rock, I thought this is going to be a fun, mindless entertainment experience, which is kind of what I'm looking for after the last couple episodes.
Sure.
And you're shaking your head like,
I don't think you're going to get that.
Great.
But I do think you can have I think you're going to get an interesting experience. My problem, I think, the last time I watched this movie was thinking that I'm going to get a fucking gung-ho, gonzo, crazy, cool-looking, rocking movie.
And I watched it
and I was like, oh.
What is it like to watch Bad Boys 2?
I'm terrified. Terrified to watch it again.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the most insane experiences I've ever had in the
Terrified
theater,
is such a...
watching that movie.
What?
Well, it seriously was. I felt insane.
Terrified is such a strong word, but Kaelin's the one person I know who means that. I think you mean the word terrified.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'd be really scared to watch it again.
All right. Well, let's not get derailed on Bad Boys 2.
We should talk about it later. I mean, as we talk about Michael Bay, I'd love to talk about all his movies. Because the fact is, the only movies in the bag of our era that Michael Bay actually did are Bad Boys, Rock, and Armageddon.
Mm-hmm. I think. I do not want to watch Armageddon again.
I do.
I don't, man. I watched it more than once. That doesn't matter here.
You saw Armageddon more than once and you saw The Rock zero times?
Yeah, that's what happened.
That's crazy.
There's a lot of crapshoot stuff happening in the 90s for me. It's just like, hey, people are going to do this. Do you want to come? I was like, yeah, I like those people. I'll go do that thing.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing is, let's just say this before we go into the movie. It's got a fucking unbelievably great, incredible, extraordinary cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage, Ed Harris, among many others. All, like, it's got a stacked cast of people you know. And
not as good as True Romance, I bet.
No, there's essentially no cast as good as the True Romance cast. Anyway, let's go try it out.
So, wait, are you worried? Or are you excited, Spencer?
I'm game. I'm into it.
I mean, worried nor excited.
It's you're neither like, yeah, worried fine. Nor excited. Yeah. But
you're grayish and you're fine.
Yeah, that's right. I'm great.
We've come full circle.
I'm between great and fine on this. That's called growing up.
Here we go. Let's go watch The Rock.
Why didn't you just tell them where the microfilm was and create a solution?
The moment they had the microfilm, they'd suicide me. Some solution.
You ended up here. Which brings me to another question. When you broke out, let me see if I can get this straight. You went down the incinerator chute, on the mine car, through the tunnels to the power plant, under the steam engine, that was really cool, by the way, and into the cistern through the intake pipe, but how, in the name of Zeus's butthole, did you get out of yourself? I only ask because in our current situation, well, it could prove to be useful information. Maybe!
trade secrets, my son.
So. Did you start it?
Oh, yeah. I want to get right into it. I want to move at the pace of the film.
Can I begin? Is that okay with you guys?
Yeah, if you acknowledge your one fatal mistake.
I just want the first thing I want to say is I my favorite thing on the show of anything that happens is when we're wrong, and I am so delighted to have been so completely wrong.
Well, I don't think you were wrong. I think you made a fatal flaw.
What was my flaw?
You didn't watch it with us.
I mean, maybe, but I think that things have changed for me, and I like there's watching the movie. I was sort of like, what? I vacillated between what was wrong with me and what is wrong with me. And I don't know which is more apt question.
Who'd you watch it with? And did were you alone?
I watched it with Eve, and we love this shit. And so that's I don't know what I mean. Like what?
These movies can get you in a cycle. Once you start like, this is dumb, I hate it, you end up in a fucking whirlpool sometimes.
Yeah, it's mood, man. It's mood and timing. That we have to talk about that in the context of this show is how much of this shit is just where are you the day you watch a movie? It's so weird.
And where you slot into the first 15 minutes. If you like accept it and go with it and enjoy it and you're with the right people.
Yeah,
it
but
can
I
really
don't
be fun.
I don't recognize the myself that wouldn't have clocked in at 15 minutes into this
film. Bet it lost you during the car chase. Anyway, we'll get into that. Because if you're going to lose it somewhere, it's got to be during that.
No.
Scene.
Well, what'd you think of it?
I had the best time.
Yeah?
I had the best time. Okay. Spencer?
I had a wonderful time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great time.
Yeah.
You know, I stopped short of saying great movie. But I had a great time watching it, and I thought it was a really It delivered the opposite of boredom 100% of the time.
Yeah, that's right.
It did deliver the opposite of boredom. That's totally true.
What a great tagline for the film. The opposite of boredom.
Starring Sean Connery.
All the time.
I'm looking at this poster, which is kind of a great poster, even though it's just heads. But what's weird about it is, having watched the movie, Sean Connery and Alcatraz are like not even the movie. Like that's almost not the thing. The Rock as an idea, it could have been anywhere. It just happens to be Alcatraz. Oh, yeah. And Sean Connery is barely in the film in a funny, weird way.
He's not a plot linchpin, but he's around.
He's kind of around.
You see him on screen a lot.
You know, you say it could have been anywhere, but only Alcatraz has a crazy mine train underneath it that has a track that is weirdly melted at the end, so the mine crane can fall off.
Let's revisit the conversation that happened during that scene. Travis, do you stick by your notion that has to be underneath Alcatraz?
Here's what I think.
Say what you said during the film.
I do.
Say what you said.
We'll get Spencer to do the plot. So prepare yourself, Spencer. You have to fucking work your way through.
You know what? I don't think it'll be as hard as if I do
you
it right.
That
will be easy.
You can track through it. So there's a scene where you guys know the idea. They go into Alcatraz to rescue some missiles, which we'll get into in a second. But they go beneath Alcatraz, and there's this ridiculous scene where they fall through the floor and end up in a mine cart a la Indiana Jones.
I am so glad you remembered to say they fall through the floor.
Well,
that's
important.
So important.
They happen to fall into the mine cart and then start to rocket down, and they don't know where they're going, and they're picking up speed. And we had a bit of an argument during the film. My supposition, and let me be clear what my supposition is. My supposition is there is some sort of track somewhere that transports something. And they saw it in the scout of Alcatraz. And they're like, oh, we got to write something with this. And they extended it and made it crazier. But what I'm supposing here is that you don't just come up with a minecart track sequence out of the blue. You have to have seen something to make you think that's a good idea.
And my counter is, of course you do. Of course you think that.
I think you think that if you're the type of person who is Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Who
So you think he said, we know what we need here, a minecart chase sequence.
Like right about that time, I was like, I think I said out loud, I was like, this is a little kid.
Yeah.
Like this is like a man child making a movie. There's definitely a lot of parts of the movie that aren't exactly childish. But like structurally speaking and moment by moment, a lot of the time it felt like the energy and excitement of a little boy having just seen like an action movie and being like, like reciting the plot like really excitedly.
And I kept thinking, especially of course during that sequence, is okay, now I can directly compare Michael Bay to Steven Spielberg, because Spielberg puts in a minecart chase and you know exactly where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And when Michael Bay puts it in, you're like, where is he coming from? Like, what's going on?
Wait,
I like, because it, like the joy of The Rock, I talked about confusion as a word. I maintain that I do feel like finally, and this is where I really want to fucking dig down into this. I feel like I crossed a threshold with Michael Bay, because I feel like maybe I get the guy, and I don't understand him. I may not like him, but I finally feel like that's it. That's what I've been looking for all this time, is the guy who made this movie, which is extraordinary in terms of its craft. Like, he shoots it incredibly well. It is not haphazard.
Well, wait. Yes.
But I want to talk about the mind very quickly. Okay. And then we'll go back and we'll start from the beginning. This is like the teaser for the later. The Minecraft... The craft of the minecart sequence as Minecraft is that it's not like someone comes up with it on the day. It is like intricately conceived and storyboarded, and it keeps going on and on. I mean, where the minecart ends by them launching onto an air like rail minecart that then carries the story forward onto now a minecart hanging from the ceiling instead of on the floor.
A metal basket. They don't know why they're doing what we don't know where that stuff came from or what it's for.
No.
But Michael Bay knows exactly what it's for. It's to be awesome.
There is a world in this movie where underneath Alcatraz, it's so fun. This is the kind of fun insanity that the movie is loaded with. There's a mine cart that runs down rails, and at some point the rails ran out and were twisted up into the air, so that now that launches directly into a metal basket mine cart hanging from the ceiling, which then continues down the track. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, that is such a... But it's all orchestrated in this amazing way.
Mm-hmm. Do you think... So I thought in the middle of this, I thought during the Die Hard episode, Die Hard 3 episode, we said John McTiernan shoots the shit out of action scenes. And really, you have a sense of where everything is.
Yeah,
I don't think the same thing applies here. No. And I just want to make sure that listeners understand what Kalen's describing is not a masterful action director necessarily. It's an entertaining action director. But the comprehensibility of the action scenes are 60% of what we saw with John.
Yeah,
McTiernan.
No. You're right.
I just want to clarify what you're
saying. It's a good thing
to say,
and we can talk a lot about it. Yeah, but he's not clear. Mm. It doesn't have the precision and clarity and storytelling perfection that McTiernan brings to an action scene. But it gives you everything. It just juices you with energy.
Question two before we get into Spencer's beautiful recap of the film, which is going to be awesome. And I want to prep listeners, stay tuned, because it's about to happen. So there's three credited writers on the film, and then Kalen did some research to tell us about some other uncredited writers, which we'll get to. And I think I know the answer to this, but I want to see your opinion. Is Michael Bay the kind of director where the studio goes, here, take whatever writers you want, whip the script into shape, show us when you're done? Did Michael Bay sculpt this thing? Or was this a studio producer thing and Michael Bay came on and directed it?
What I don't know for a fact. What I know about him is that he is very involved in the story, quote-unquote story process. Mm. Recently he has been. And what I loved about watching this movie, and what he has said about The Rock, is that we improvised a bunch of lines, and he's so proud of the improvised comedy, much of which came from Nicolas Cage.
I was going to say, I feel like Nicolas Cage did not say almost anything written.
Right. 9 out of 10 Cages. Here.
Right.
He's like almost top Cage.
He's decided to play a comedy. He's decided to be in a comedy, which is incredible.
So awesome.
Excellent choice.
I mean that in every possible way.
Sincerely.
It's the perfect and greatest possible choice.
It makes the movie work.
But all of that said, Michael Bay also shoots the script he has, regardless of what that script is. Like, I loved watching these really elaborate, beautiful sort of you know, camera movements that are tracking, push in, rack focus, like really gorgeous and hard to pull off shots of, like, you know, motion and focus and stuff with these fucking rando military guys saying nothing lines. Like, he shoots them as if they're heroic taglines.
Worse than nothing lines.
Yeah, but it's like, close the door. But that is this massive yeah, ramp up to this guy, this fucking gross looking old white guy going like, close the door. But like, he does it on almost every line. So he doesn't majestic. Fucking care what the line
and
is.
And the Hans Zimmer score pounds that yeah, shit when it
happens. It's incredible. It's a directing tour de force, which he doesn't seem to care what script he's shooting.
All right, Spencer, give us the plot.
I just want to say, I just have to reference the Rube Goldberg scene in the very early in the film, because that, I feel like that has that's sort of Michael Bay's way of saying, of doing his a director in joke of like, this is like what this is.
Well,
like,
they say 5 minutes into the film you're supposed to state the thesis of the film in some way,
and he does it.
That's it.
He does it when you first meet yeah. Nicolas Cage. He is playing with a Rube Goldberg device he invented in his office.
If you, Spencer, right now chose to describe in exact and intimate detail that Rube Goldberg machine instead of the plot. Mm-hmm. I'd go with it. I'd be okay with it. We wouldn't have to talk about the plot because it's the same thing.
It's
perfectly true.
It's so true, and it ends with a Hawaiian hula lady mm-hmm. being lit on fire.
Not a real
for some
one.
Reason.
It's
so the kid, and I mean
a doll yeah, one.
I'm gonna do it real. Let me just do. I'm not gonna do every detail. Let me do it real fast. The idea of this scene. This is how you meet Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
Is he and Todd Luiso from High Fidelity. Are hanging out, and they are in a science lab, and Nicolas Cage is aiming a little Nerf dart gun at a target. Okay. And he shoots the Nerf dart gun, hits the target, which sets off a chain reaction of a Rube Goldberg machine that is beyond elaborate. So they've obviously, the gag is they have nothing to do.
They takes set like up 30 seconds.
This unbelievably intricate Rube Goldberg machine, which well before the halfway mark, Todd Luiso is like, fuck, like, you did it. I owe you this money. They're exchanging money as the machine continues to go. And again, like, so many things, so many levels of element, until finally it turns on a Bunsen burner and lights a Hawaiian dancing car toy woman on fire. And that's the end. That's the end of the Rube Goldberg machine.
Can I tell you the worst thing about that to me?
What?
So that starts, and they're both in a very nonchalant position. Nicolas Cage has his feet up. So if you track the reality of the scene, they set up this Rube Goldberg machine. Both sat down.
And I sit back.
Then, like, hung out for a
yeah,
while.
Yes, yes,
and then,
yes.
Like, should we do this thing we set up for an hour and a half?
Probably all talking right. about the stakes of the bet.
Yeah, but, like, so nonchalant. It was... Anyway, that bothers me because it doesn't make any sense that they're, like, having
that
their feet up
on the
desk.
That bothers you?
Yeah, it bothers me.
That's lame. That can't bother you.
What do you mean? What do you mean by bother right now?
Because of course it doesn't bother you.
Wait, who said bother first?
Who Travis said bother? Said he, okay, Travis you said bother. Said bothers. He says that bothers me.
Do you think I mean bother in a serious way or a comedic way?
Well, I know, but how
this
are you
whole
not
movie
just
bothers
utterly
me, but I'm delighted by it. No, it bothers me.
I was going to say the word delighted.
Well, obviously,
there's nothing. There's
but
no
that's
bother.
That's funny though. Of course, you should be bothered by that, but not like oh, no, oh I can't believe they
no,
did that.
No, and like I'm so glad I'm not bothered.
The
like,
Rock,
that's the only way you're bothered.
The Rock is a bothersome delight.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. Movie. That's right.
All right. The plot right, of
okay,
which is
so. Ed Harris, who plays a general. I don't remember the names of most anyone.
Except for Stanley
Goodspeed.
Goodspeed
and James Mason?
Mason.
It's not James.
Not
James
Mason.
But I don't... Mason.
They just call him Mason.
Someone
something.
Mason.
Something Mason.
John Mason? So the general that is played by Ed Harris is supposedly avenging the unheralded deaths of many military men and his wife, his dead wife, who is one of them, I guess. Right?
I didn't even put that together.
That was the first scene?
Who knows?
Yeah, I guess.
Which is, again, I mean, this is going to be hard not to do with a movie like this, and we sometimes fall into this trap. But
yeah.
That scene of Ed Harris, so the scene is Ed Harris standing at his wife's grave.
Opening scene of the film.
Almost. But being torrentially pounded by rain.
By beautiful fake rain.
With no cover, in full military regalia. Speaking... quietly.
Oh man!
But, forcefully.
Yes.
You don't just speak loudly to a corpse.
No,
they hear
but
you.
Like
they know they can hear you, bro.
Yet he's very clear and forceful. Yeah.
You don't have to use your voice.
I just like I'm watching this scene, being like, this dude is so wet. He's so fucking crazy wet. Yeah. And loved it, of course.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
I was
good.
that really when I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, I was totally
yeah,
wrong. I was obviously wrong. And you're right, it is minute like two
yeah.
of the film.
Yeah. So right. Okay, so I won't try I'll try not to get bogged down in
get
the minute.
Bogged down. Let,
but
live
but,
life.
But so so
like, you do you
live
on this
your
one.
Life.
This is gonna be good.
So
I will say this before. Sorry to interrupt you for the fifth time. I'm as excited to hear your summary as I was halfway through the film. I'm like into what you're about to say.
So he
go deep. Bro.
So this general seems like he's about to do something very noble. He's that's the position that the movie puts him in. He really it really gives you the sense that he's about to
he's
stand
a,
up
he's
for
a
what's
true
right.
True patriot.
He's a real patriot.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, before really anything happens, we meet. Goodspeed, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cage. Who is Nicolas Cage, Stanley Goodspeed, and
what do we learn about him?
We learn that he's a FBI agent who's expert in chemicals, chemical warfare.
A self-proclaimed
a Beatle maniac.
That's right, he's a Beatle maniac. A $600 copy of Meet the Beatles on vinyl, 1996. Shows up on his desk.
I'm going to talk about this a lot. I love the 90s.
Yeah.
Because the 90s as an era of filmmaking is they know the rules of like classic filmmaking. And they're still kind of doing the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But like and the rule says you got to give this guy a trait.
Mm-hmm.
All right, he's a Beatle maniac.
He loves the Beatles.
Now move on.
Now the 90s, the other part of the 90s is that is never referenced
no,
for
ever.
The rest of the film.
Give him the
no,
thing and
not
move
once.
On.
And you would yeah. think it would be.
Let's,
there's so
you know
much
what that
opportunity.
Was? Let's do a character pass. All right, he likes the Beatles. I don't know. That's what that
it's
was.
Amazing.
He likes the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
He likes the Beatles. He has a beautiful girlfriend who he really enjoys making love to on a rooftop that has more candles than any rooftop has ever had.
600 candles that they took time to light, I assume, before penetration.
Yes.
I don't know why. Like, what are they doing?
They just they set it up. They just got someone's got to set
well,
it up.
He's
so
just,
might as well
he's
be
just found out he's about to be a father.
That's true. Important. So he learns he's
it's
about
a
to be
a special night.
He goes home.
We're
oh,
never
no,
getting through
he
the
doesn't
plot
go
of this
home.
Film.
He doesn't go home. I feel like I could... See, here's the thing that happened just now. I feel like I could do this in 30 seconds, but it's too fun to talk about all the stupid details.
I think that this podcast should be Spencer trying to get through the plot, and we just talking about it as it happens, because that's a fine way to go about it, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
I mean, the 30-second plot is there's a...
how dare you.
The guy is... The guy who we thought was a patriot is a psychopathic, almost a psychopathic terrorist who leads a group of psychopathic terrorists, and they
all
threaten
from the military.
They threaten to bomb San Francisco with from Alcatraz by taking hostage because of this crazy idea that he has that the American government has wronged him, but he doesn't
actually
go through with it. What's that?
They didn't wrong him. They wronged his men.
They wronged his men, right? And he's mad about that. Right. So they wronged his men. And when the time comes, they reach the deadline for him to fire the missiles at the city of San Francisco.
Right.
This is an hour and 45 minutes in the movie.
You're also 45 seconds into your 30-second summary and haven't mentioned the Sean Connery.
I haven't mentioned
at
any
all.
Of that yet because this is the sort of actual plot of the movie.
Yeah, it's true.
Is that? And you pointed this out during the film.
Right.
Is that he doesn't actually go through with it.
Yeah.
And nothing anyone has done for the entire duration of the film up to this point has affected that decision.
It's true.
And so he if you think
this
of it
is
as
a movie where the two ostensible heroes, Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, totally fail the mission.
They don't.
100%. The deadline passes.
Yeah.
They fail.
Yeah.
The missile launches, and only by the grace of Ed Harris's like second guessing himself,
he decides to reorient the missile, and he's like, "I'm not going to
do
that."
I can't do this.
And with that at that moment, his men turn against him, and Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, who have character names that I will get to when we actually describe their characters, disarm those psychopathic men. And the movie ends with the hostages being saved.
Yeah, it really is incredible. I mean, fine. I guess that does the trick, and now we can sort of talk
now we can back go back
through.
And talk yes. about how insane it is when Nicolas Cage finds out his wife is pregnant, his girlfriend is pregnant, and then his girlfriend proposes marriage to him, and
as a way to begin I loved that scene, not even in a jokey way, in a way where I'm like, this scene is fantastic because it's broad, it's ridiculous, and Nicolas Cage is so funny
with his so turnarounds,
and his lines are even good.
Whoa, yeah. Like, marriage police, it's slow down.
Marriage police, slow down.
Marriage police, slow down.
Pull over, I believe. Marriage police, pull over.
Yeah, that's right. He has a guitar in his lap. He says he's been playing. He clearly cannot play the
guitar. Cannot play guitar.
He plays one note and he just goes, bow. Anyway, rough day. How's yours?
Oh, so the rough day he had was that for some reason, we assume, does this have to do with anyone in the movie?
It just introduces the idea of the
needle. It sets up that he has to stab himself in the chest.
So
he's a good bomb diffuser guy.
Yeah. Right. Which, again, just cutting wires. Like, I know how to defuse a bomb. From Die Hard 3 in this, I got it.
Literally.
You sweat for about 95% of the timer, whatever the timer happens, whether it's 4 days or 20 seconds.
And then you go,
and then
clear!
You cut the wire. That's it.
Yep.
I got it. Go on.
So terrorists send a bomb to the FBI.
Oh, my God.
And they happen to be in the, you know, they're opening the box that has the bomb in it and also a chemical bomb as well.
Couple points about this.
Yeah,
so, sorry.
While they're inside the protective chamber.
So the first thing,
and they're in gas suits.
Okay, so Nicolas Cage and his buddy, they open up the box, and the first thing he pulls out is dirty magazines,
but
so like
also
Playboys.
Old porn.
Yeah, old porn.
That's what they pull out.
And so then you think one of two things is happening. One, it's a false alarm and it's just a bunch of bullshit. Or two, it's supposed to be a disguised bomb, right?
Right.
And then they pull out a gas mask.
They're
and
oh boy.
You think, oh, okay, I guess it's actually a real thing.
Nicolas Cage says, that's a bad sign.
That's a bad sign. And as an audience member, you think, bad sign. It's a gas mask.
Why would the bad guys pack a gas mask?
So now you're like, oh, what is this? Why is there nudie magazines and a gas mask? Then he pulls out a baby doll.
That's right.
That his highly trained partner decides to hold up in front of his face and wave an arm and go, oh, I'm a little guy.
Yeah.
And everyone in the room, except for him, apparently goes, that's a bad idea. Like, don't do that. Don't touch the baby doll.
And he's like, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this that I'm doing? And he continues
and
to
the baby
furiously
doll,
pump the baby doll arm.
Yeah. Baby doll's mouth
until
starts,
it starts to
spew
smoke.
Deadly gas out of its mouth.
Yeah.
Now, my question is,
which starts a 3-minute absolute batshit panic
wait,
scene.
Wait, let's get into that. My question precedes that, which is, when the terrorists packed the crate, why did they put the nudie magazines in? Honest question. I'm asking
this,
very honestly.
Because for this experience of the bomb diffuser people who are going to have to find all this out. I mean,
these terrorists are characters in another movie.
That's what I'm saying. Because gas mask out and you have a baby doll and porn magazines, which is amazing for a package.
Totally.
But they threw a gas mask in and fucked up the whole vibe of that package.
And there's an actual bomb in there also.
There's also a bomb. Yeah, so there's this baby doll spewing poison gas
and a bomb.
That's going to blow up the entire FBI headquarters.
When Spencer says 3 minutes of batshit chaos, it's so true.
It's so good,
they are
though.
All losing their minds over this.
No one seems
they
to know.
They can't
it's
turn
the
on
bomb
the sprinklers,
unit.
which you're supposed to.
And when they do, they say, sprinklers activated.
2 minutes and 50 seconds into a 3-minute bomb.
Oh my God.
His partner,
all of these professionals,
doesn't know what to do.
Losing their mind.
No protocol has been set.
Is to deal with these situations.
Nicolas Cage, ostensibly the best expert in the world at chemical weapons, we are told, has a partner who's his first day. He doesn't even know what his costume does.
Yeah, basically.
Oh,
that's
shit.
Basically right.
Yeah, that partner is utterly useless.
I mean, untrained.
He does nothing.
He doesn't do nothing.
He
fucks
panics.
Up everything.
He screws up. He's bad.
Panics.
And argues about the protocol. Your protocol is stab yourself in the heart with this needle. And he's like, what?
I know.
This needle?
Now, I will say, though, as much as I loved the entire film, I loved that portion of the film almost more than anything else. I loved that portion of the film, and I loved the last 40 seconds of the film, which those yeah. that is the like the end of the movie.
We, oh yeah, this God. We really have to.
I don't know I think even we, how to get into this.
I think we really have to save the okay. end okay. for the end. Okay, and okay. I think we have to save kind of what
I
that means.
I think a successful podcast is if the audience gets the same experience from us describing.
Well,
let,
can
we
I
got
can
them.
I just pause for a second here because I would imagine that a lot of people have seen The Rock.
I had not. Spencer had not.
But a yeah. lot of people have, and if they haven't. I don't know that I want to ruin it for them, and I want to say go see The Rock.
No, this like, is a spoiler alert.
Try
podcast.
The Rock.
We spoil movies, man.
I know, but that's not really the point of the show.
No,
I mean,
no,
the
no,
point
no.
of the show
it's,
is
it's an unavoidable from what we do. We talk
as
about,
long as we walk through it, we aren't just recounting the plot and laughing.
No,
about it, which would be a misery. I don't
no,
want to be that show.
No, I understand that, but I think that this offers an opportunity to express what's great about the film by talking okay. about specific moments.
Okay.
Yeah, I hope that our joy that we experienced watching this movie. Has come across and will continue to come across as we
it's
talk about it.
It's goddamn delightful.
Yeah. You will have a grand old time.
Do not watch it by yourself. Or I guess with your wife, question mark? I don't know what happened there. But watch it
either.
With a bunch of people.
Yeah,
and
watch
the more
it,
people, the better.
Watch
yeah,
it
you know, it's also part of expectations. You know, I somehow, this time, my expectations were so low.
What about
that
low
I,
or
no,
high?
No, but wait. But they were low and I found something crazy. And I think when I went into it last time, I was too serious. I was looking yeah, yeah, yeah. for something very serious to understand this guy, Michael Bay. Even though I knew he was kind of a trash artist, I was fucking trying too hard. The Rock is not a movie that you need to be, obviously,
look
you don't
chaos.
Need to be thinking very hard. This is going to give you a theme park ride good time. And it's you know, complicated by all sorts of garbage, which is also in the movie.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that too, but like, it's just such a successful experience, regardless of what they were trying to do. Now, we can also talk about what maybe they were trying to do.
I think he nailed what he was trying to do.
Well, what I was going to ask, the question that kept running through my mind, and maybe I can say this now, is...
How aware is he?
Like, who's kidding? Like, in the entire... Across the board, from Nicolas Cage to Sean Connery to Michael Bay to Hans Zimmer to the cinematographers to the editors, like... Who's thinks this is fun and funny, and who doesn't? Like, it doesn't matter. And where does Michael Bay sit?
Everyone except
spectrum?
For Ed Harris, I think, is kind of in on the joke. Is my take on it. Ed Harris plays the shit, and he does a very good job.
He's good.
I'm not knocking Ed Harris. He kills it, but he is in a different film. He's
does
very
he
serious.
Kill it? Because
I think he's great.
He's good, but it's so absurd that I kept feeling like.
No
I
one
felt
told
kind
him what
of
they were doing.
Him.
Well, no one told him what they were doing. Like Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery are doing the same.
But did someone
thing.
Tell them, or did they just?
I think
did...
they amongst themselves. You're like, hey, let's do it this way. And he's like, cool, cool. Michael Bay doesn't fuck. He's looking
well,
at something else.
I think this movie. I think that the Ed Harris sort of plot line, which is the, I guess, plot.
Yeah.
Is the one that weirdly works as like a. Vaguely dramatic one because it's like
it could be the plot of any
and,
number of bad movies
yeah and
like,
and when Ed Harris dies ignominiously because his plot was or, his plan was so wrong-headed and
right.
and cruel and weird and bad and results in all of his men dying and stuff when he dies ignominiously in a way that's like, the movie almost, at least in that moment, kind of gets that there could be a gravity to this story.
Let me, right. Just because...
Except for the rest of the movie.
Right. We keep talking around it. Let me just say that one part, because Spencer's right. hit on it. But the actual plan is, Ed Harris, he commanded a bunch of troops in Vietnam, and a bunch of troops, I guess in the Tet Offensive, as a reference, which is weird, and then also in Desert Storm. He lost 80-something men. Their families were not compensated, and those people died sort of unrecognized.
Well, it's that he, to be specific, I believe it's that he lost men in Iraq because they were running black ops when the American government bombed Iraq.
Correct. They're the guys who put lasers on the targets and they bombed them.
Right.
And they were not, because
they were
black
killed.
Ops, they weren't
yeah.
their families weren't compensated and they weren't honored. And so his plan to get the family money is he hires a bunch of mercenaries drawn from Special Forces and U.S. Marines, takes a bunch of missiles loaded with the most poisonous gas in the world, takes over Alcatraz with human hostages, aims the missiles at San Francisco, calls the Pentagon and says, I have these missiles. I'm going to fire on San Francisco and kill millions of people if you don't give $100 million to me. a million of which each will go to the families of my fallen soldiers, and I disperse the rest of this money to the basically to the mercenaries. So that's his plan, and then he issues that challenge. You have 40 hours to respond. Go. Okay. So that's
for helping me with my great plot synopsis.
Well, sorry, but
no, I'm just saying you did a pretty good job.
That's just his plan because we kept talking around his plan. Right, so you guys understand what the fuck his plan was. Right.
His plan is
because the movie doesn't tell you until about an hour in.
It takes a long time.
It does take a while, and I think part of the reason why it takes a while is again could be dramatically justified if the movie decided to be a drama,
right?
Which is like his plan at first. You kind of get swept up in, General Ed Harris is, that's what I'm going to call him.
Yeah.
General Ed Harris is very justified. It might be very justified in doing this crazy thing. And then you find out what the crazy thing is and you're like, maybe he's not very justified. And then it keeps going farther and farther and you're like, boy, he really isn't. And then he doesn't pull the trigger on the plan.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, even he realized he'd gone too far.
If we wanted to be that show, there is a lot to unpack in this movie's treatment of patriotism. It actually is kind of a complex and bizarre angle on the concept of patriotism.
And which Michael Bay, I'm sure, I haven't seen any of his other army movies, but he's made more than one.
Absolutely. And funnily enough, this movie is the first time I've ever in my life wanted to watch that 13 Hours movie because I'm very curious about how similar it is to this, you know, because that has a similar complexity, I'm sure, about the
maybe it's the drama parts of this movie without the other hour and 45 minutes.
But let's hope not. Let's hope there's still some crazy.
Because the hour and 45 minutes, again, I mean, 10 minutes ago, we were actually laughing maybe too hard about what the fuck is going on in the rest of this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is way more. Like.
So you got 7 minutes in.
I got really not very far.
So let's go back. So we haven't even introduced the other main character, the guy.
So we've laid
the
character track for Nicolas Cage. His wife is pregnant. So, he's about to be a father. He loves the Beatles.
He's a chemical weapons expert.
So then the Pentagon is discussing what to do about this at some point. They learn from General Ed Harris that this plan is in action.
And they figure, well, we got it. Someone has the bright idea. Let's call the world's greatest bomb diffuser expert.
Yeah, they call him. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, let's get Nicolas Cage involved. And Nicolas Cage, Goodspeed, is like, I gotta go, honey.
He answers mid-coitus.
Yeah, he's having sex.
And talks to...
He's giving a monologue whilst having coitus. Yes. And then his monologue is interrupted by the phone.
His passion... It's a monologue. I would say it's a monologue of passion.
Do you remember what it was?
No.
Okay, it was really weird.
It was weird. I remember it was weird.
Yeah, it was weird with like lots of big words and some sort of poetry or something.
It was
weird. Anyway.
He was extrapolating beautifully the way Nicolas Cage did
poetic
in general throughout the film. So they get him. Yeah. Then the next idea they have is to call this guy.
They're like, we have to send a team into Alcatraz.
Yeah, so Nicolas Cage is one of them. And
well,
of course,
he doesn't know that yet,
but he's going. He doesn't know that, but he will be.
They're putting the team together,
and they're putting the team together. And the missing piece of this team—they're
basically like, we don't know how to get into Alcatraz. Yeah. This place is impenetrable,
Who do they call? The missing piece of this team is a guy who they say doesn't exist. They're like, he's been erased from the records of United States citizenry or the world citizenry or whatever. We've been keeping him since he escaped from Alcatraz in the early 60s. And he is Sean Connery. And they go meet with Sean Connery to negotiate his pardon in exchange for helping them out with this mission. And he acts like a complete maniac.
It's so good.
That entire sequence.
So what we find out, what they really want, all they want from Sean Connery is for him to tell them how you get into Alcatraz.
That really is all
they
want.
They want him to sit there and look at some blueprints of Alcatraz and say, here's how I go in.
And the thing is, the actual answer, he couldn't have told them, which works, but they didn't know that until much
later.
That's
what I was going to say. All they want is for him to tell them how to do it.
Yeah.
But they only find that out after they've pardoned him, and then they get him into a situation room, and they're like, all right, how do you do it?
And he's like,
and he's like, looking at the blueprints, and he almost hits somebody in the face with one of them, and he's like, I don't know. I have to do it myself. And they're like, damn, this is part of the plan.
We didn't do it.
Even though we pardoned you for this, this isn't part of the plan.
After he's already thrown a man over a balcony, he's bantered with a gay barber.
Astro's already done that, hasn't he?
Crazy car chase.
He's killed people in the streets of San Francisco.
In between that.
It's a 10-minute car chase.
And that's another, that brings me to my favorite plot hole, quote unquote, about the movie, which is, early in the film, this hostage situation is discussed by the Pentagon, and one of the first things they say is, maybe the first thing they say is, the city of San Francisco cannot know about this. Yeah. It will be chaos. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
And so then they get this guy out of jail, and as a direct result of getting him out of jail, before they even get him into a situation room to ask him the question that they could have asked him in the fucking jail,
yeah,
he wrecks countless vehicles, kills people on civilians on the city of San Francisco.
Blows up a cable car.
And
not just
Nicholas...
blows up, blows 30 feet off the ground because it runs into a different car. I don't know how that even happened.
And on top of that, Goodspeed goes from being a mild-mannered chemical expert
to Tom Cruise.
To Tom Cruise, who can, or Jason Bourne or whatever, who can drive a Ferrari through the streets of San Francisco where he's never been.
Or Nicolas Cage in Gone in 60 Seconds.
Or that. Like a complete maniac. A lot of maniac talk in this movie. I think I'm going to say the word maniac.
It's okay.
And so that happens.
And there are what you said during the film, and I'm sure you were going to say too, is that there remain
81
all these
hostages
on the island
overnight
with no repercussion or question.
The way they handle that is the guy at one point in the situation room goes, "I will have to talk to their families or something." That's it. That's how they handle it.
That is what they say.
Someone will have to call their families.
81 hostages, a giant, insane, colossal car chase.
I mean,
carnage,
colossal.
Total carnage, and like Alcatraz just closes for the day, because it's a bunch of tourists. Like,
I mean, did they kill that one Alcatraz guard? I'm just curious. Did he die, that goofball, or did he just wind up in the cell?
Oh, we never saw him again.
He's just in the cell.
Yeah, he's in the cell, probably. Right. Anyway, they dragged him off, put him in the cell.
Throughout all this, the city of San Francisco is in the opposite of a state of chaos because, thank God, they kept it classified, even though...
It's so
calm, in fact, that Sean Connery's character shows up to meet his daughter at the Palace of Fine Arts in broad daylight after he has been responsible for killing many
really
people on the streets of San Francisco.
Decision.
Which is a scene I loved because it comes immediately after this insane car chase, and he is really just there to tell his... All of this car chase was in order to get an opportunity to tell his daughter, "I'm not an evil man."
That's right.
Which is amazing.
And
it's
by
a
the
really
way,
beautiful juxtaposition.
The daughter... Never seen again. Never spoken of again.
Yes, totally.
Never referenced again.
No.
He just says he had hoped one day to meet his daughter.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah,
and
he met her.
Early in the film.
Met her early.
And I guess also it's to give... I guess the idea behind it is to give both Nicolas Cage, whose girlfriend has flown to San Francisco for... That doesn't matter why. And Sean Connery both have relatives that it mattered to them in San Francisco where the bombs are pointed.
And yet,
that's
even despite
idea
that, Sean Connery is...
Not
always
interested.
Ready to walk
yeah,
away.
Not interested.
It's just constantly
super
cavalier.
Yeah. Also, importantly, during that entire 20-minute sequence where they're trying to catch him and he's like running away, and there's a car chase, and then there's a motorcycle chase, and then he's in the National Museum. You're not sure as an audience member he can actually help the mission that we're talking about at all. You ditch away from the main plot for 30 minutes in this film, and you're not clear he's able to help them at all.
Well, and what you find out watching the movie is that this isn't one movie. You find out watching it fairly early on, this is about 12 movies. Like, this is 14, 15, 16 movies. Like, they're all... And the thing that defined the film for me and what maybe defines Michael Bay is, like, he's like a man of many moods. And it doesn't... He just goes from whim to whim and has no sense that you're supposed to keep a tone or a control.
In the realm of our podcast, though, I am extremely nostalgic for this type of movie. Like, I legit love this type of movie.
I thought about that a lot. While I was watching it, I was starting to try to brew this theory that the 90s were peak movies. Like, that they,
I get
that
it,
they,
man.
That I
get
really
it.
Was like, did they ever beat this? Because it's the ultimate, like, everything movie. Like this movie is an everything movie. There mm-hmm. is you there's we talked a lot about all these various horror shots. Like there's this scene very early on in the film where a guy is doused in poison gas and his skin melts and bubbles. It's exactly awesome. Like Toxic Avenger.
Awesome.
It's crazy horror shit. And it's a comedy and it's an action movie and it's a drama and it's this, you know, sentimental Capra thing where, you know, John Connery has his own little flute theme, you know, when he talks to his daughter about
Sean Connery, Scottish actor, has an Irish flute theme.
which is to be fair, like the closest thing in the movie to being like an accurate thing. Like
so,
it's, yeah. That's as close
so,
as he gets.
But all of that, I was thinking like it's not quite true because movies like The Rock still roll around. They're not indicative of an era. This movie really is an example of, but it's far outside the 90s era. And what made me think that was how much I love Fast and Furious. Mm. And I was like, oh, yeah, they're still totally. Making the fucking Rock. Yeah, and it's called yeah. Fast and Furious 7. Like, it's still out there.
How'd you love that and not like this?
I don't know. It's really weird. Something happened. Something went very wrong.
You were in a fight
with
my
last
wife.
I don't think it had anything to do with Eve. We just watched XXX, The Return of Xander Cage.
Yeah.
It was damn good.
Yeah, the billboards. Is he riding a motorcycle on a wave or something? Dude, in the billboard?
No, yeah, he has a motorcycle jet ski.
How do you fucking beat that?
It's pretty great. Yeah, it's pretty great.
I was wondering how you were going to tie this movie into the theme of the podcast, only because as someone who didn't see this movie or any action movies in the 90s, really,
yeah.
when they came yeah. out, I don't have any nostalgia for this at all. Right. I felt I was watching this and like honestly now is kind of my peak time to enjoy this kind of movie.
Well, I obviously very clearly enjoyed this more now than I ever have in my entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, when I saw it as a kid, I think I probably thought it was fun or whatever, but like I couldn't differentiate. I didn't know the difference.
Well, that like we were talking about how when that mine train scene comes on, it's like the Goonies, right? And so like if you're watching this as a
Goonies.
Kid, and you're familiar with adventure films, you know, this movie has sort of the energy of one of those
yes.
movies for it's most of its running time.
It's all energy. It's yeah. Michael Bay is all energy. And here's what I would say, and I really mean it. Watch, at least in this film, and I haven't obviously, I would like to watch more of his movies now with feeling like I now have an endpoint. But he's so talented, he just has no... control.
Yeah.
He has no control.
Self-restraint.
But he's in any given moment, he's an incredibly good director.
You talked about this in Die Hard with a Vengeance, and I thought a lot about it, which was in the 80s and 90s, action movies used to be fun. It was fun.
Right.
And that's the thing I felt here is that it almost feels like, and you said kids' movie, it's certainly not a kids' movie. There's gruesome violence in this film. Pretty regularly.
Unless you're Kaylin, then it's a
kid. Oh, that's what I was going to say, exactly. Kaylin's parents would have showed up to him at age 6.
Right.
And you know what's funny? I do have memories, fond memories of my parents going to see The Rock and coming back and saying, like, this was a really funny, fun movie.
Yeah.
Not
for kids, but Kaylin's right that there was a time period where action movies were fun and they were supposed to be fun first and foremost. And then there's this like bifurcation into hard R and sort of PG-13 movies.
Yeah, you know what?
Like.
You know what? It's I thought
around
about,
this time.
I thought about Bourne. When does Bourne show up? That's like 2001 or 2002 or something.
Yeah, maybe
mm-hmm. maybe
bit, yeah.
maybe 2000.
That
like,
seems right.
Like that fucked it up, man. Like the it was cool for a minute to take action movies seriously again or for the first time. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the Fast and Furious series is the. There's a reason that I am so deeply in love with it, and it's really because it captures this zany spirit of fun at the movies.
Yeah.
Mission
Impossible has moments where it'll do
Mission
it.
Impossible does it.
You know?
For sure.
Yeah. But for the most part, yeah, they kind of split into, like, serious or PG or R. And
just
this one is, like,
point,
R,
well,
but it's
but
fun
you know
as
what?
Fuck.
But here's the thing. Mission Impossible is not zany.
No, you're
this
right.
This movie's fucking zany.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
crazy.
Wacky.
Yeah.
And, it like, it's very... proud of it, like especially looking at Nicolas Cage's performance. Like he got into movies to be a wackadoo, and he just goes for it at every chance. He says lines funny. He moves his body funny.
He's doing
he's
the
basically
thing you know he
in
does.
Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Like
in the last scene, which we'll get to, he is in Raising Arizona.
Yeah, yeah,
straight up.
He finally bends the movie into Raising Arizona. That's how it ends.
That's right. He exerts his Cageian will upon the film.
And by the way, this is fucking 2 years, 1 year after leaving Las Vegas. Like, crazy. This guy is at the peak of his prestige. And he does this, and it's this hilarious. Like,
he's so, yeah. I mean, we were talking about how his character is somewhat nonsensical because it goes from being muscular badass to brainy chemical weapons expert to total fraidy cat, I guess is the phrase that comes to mind. Just like a complete, you know, like a shell-shocked dude.
Well, this is super interesting because who could do that except Nicolas Cage, mm-hmm. who we have seen do mm-hmm. all of those things.
Yeah.
So when you see a character who does all of those ridiculous things and in concert with each other,
yeah.
You buy every second of it. It's not an inconsistent character. It's Nicolas Cage. We know that guy. He does all of it.
The only thing that makes it inconsistent is that all of those things are happening in different scenes. Like, he doesn't switch from one to the other in the space of a scene.
Yeah, it's like a scared scene.
It's like
or
in
a
one scene, he's
scene.
Like one guy, and then another scene, he's like another guy. And that's not Nicolas Cage's fault, because Nicolas Cage plays it perfectly every time.
Each scene's played pitch perfect.
No, he's not a consistent character. He's always reliably Nicolas Cage.
And you're watching it and you're loving it.
Of course. You're loving it. Totally. Totally.
So they assemble the team.
They assemble.
Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage are now part of a SEAL team.
They are part of a SEAL team.
Which also includes Michael Biehn or Bean. We've had this debate before and I can't remember what we settled on. Bean?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yep.
They insert themselves into Alcatraz.
We find out that what Sean Connery had done is memorize
the pattern of a bunch of fire flumes and like
rolling gears
in this tiny little space.
It's as dumb as you think.
It's Indiana
awesome.
Jones and the Last Crusade. Yeah. He has just memorized the pattern of rolling his body through a furnace.
And it's been 32 years, and he's like,
and
I hope it's still the same.
He's doing it backwards, to be clear.
That's right, he's doing it backwards.
It doesn't make any sense, and it's so dumb.
And it is dumb, and it's really funny.
Because
you just see his body, or a person's body, sort of rolling around in the middle of some fire.
All I kept thinking is, a very old man is rolling through a fire, and we're just like holding a camera shot on it, and that's fine.
Yeah,
it's really weird.
It's a very serious movie about a general who's upset.
Can I also say that in that scene, one of the things I loved is that the other Navy SEALs who are waiting for him to come out of the other side of the furnace.
Yeah.
They stand there, and when he doesn't show up
they're like, he ditched us.
We lost inside Alcatraz. What are they talking about? It's nonsensical.
And also, I have to say, there's a body double, obviously, at some point that comes in. But when it's clearly Sean Connery rolling, he's a very bad roller. Like, Sean Connery rolls very awkwardly, and it made me uncomfortable.
Great. He's doing that.
Sean Connery's still alive, you guys. Isn't that great?
I was thinking about
that.
Awesome.
It's pretty good, I guess. It's pretty nice to think.
It's really nice.
Did he get weird and like Trumpy and racist, or is he still cool?
Connery? No. Yeah, he's still cool. He's great. He's a weird guy who says that women deserve slaps or whatever, but he's great.
Okay.
Great stuff.
Is it okay if I don't comment on that comment?
I just mean that he's still himself.
Sure. Can we just move on?
He was always weird.
Yeah, it's great. Let's just move on.
Weird.
Yeah, maybe we just move on from that comment.
Oh, and we did, by the way, overlook. We did overlook something, which is. The kind of thing that you have to
goes, yeah, he's cool. He still says slap women, but you know.
No, I was
your example of him
always,
being cool.
That wasn't an example of him being cool. That was an example of him always being weird.
He's still cool. He says he still slaps women. Anyway.
I think this is a segue to going back to the San Francisco car chase. Just before that happens, they are at the top of the Fairmont Hotel, where he has requested or required a suite and a suit and a haircut and a shave.
I want the feel of a suit.
He wants the feel of a suit. The feel of a suit.
So there's also a pretty incredible scene where he is, I assume it's scripted or the director told him, you have to sing along to if you're going to San Francisco.
He doesn't know the words.
He knows the words.
He's going, if you're going to San Francisco.
Well, he also says them, he'll say the line right after the line. The song will go, if you're going to San Francisco.
Yeah, so now that we've reached this scene, The one thing that I want to register and say is that Michael Bay is an asshole piece of shit.
Yeah.
Because of the barber?
Because every movie has this shit.
Yeah,
and really, that is one thing I know about, I remember about all his movies.
I super hate that.
They always have and I'm using my voice in this way on purpose, a gay guy.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the gayest guy shows up. And that is in itself a hilarious joke to Michael Bay.
In this movie, played by Anthony Clark of the Boston Common sitcom.
Right. Yeah, right. Right. As we all know.
The lead character from a sitcom.
It also, his movies also feature black people.
Yeah. Yelling. Like,
where they're just being so black in this really horrible, horrible way.
The thing that the black characters, I should not use the word characters. The thing that the black people he puts in his movie,
yeah,
that he makes them do stuff, and the gay caricatures,
yes,
they have in common that they are both sassy in their own way. And isn't that what they are?
You know, right? What's interesting?
That's just what they are.
Compare this to James Cameron's Aliens. And that movie's full of tropes and weird stuff. And I think Michael Bay sees that and goes, oh, I know what he's doing. And then misses what he's doing and just goes for stereotypes instead of tropes.
But here's the thing. I mean, one story that I've been told about Michael Bay, let's say on Transformers. It was on Transformers 3, I think, mm-hmm. was the story. It was whichever one Ken Jeong was in.
Right.
And there are scenes in that movie that are inexplicable, where Ken Jeong is being so weird. So weird. And he's funny, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the story that I was told... about the shooting of those scenes is that they went on for as long as you could imagine, which is forever, of Ken Jeong being insane, nobody laughing except Michael Bay.
Oh,
and he was like, this is gold. And so what, and I say that in a weird way to praise him, not to praise his homophobia, not to praise his deep-seated racism, right, and not to praise his bad sense of humor, but this is a guy who doesn't give a fuck what anybody else thinks. Mm-hmm. I know what's good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't care. And he's not, it's a weird differentiation from like a desperate to please crowd pleaser guy. He doesn't care.
He thinks it's cool.
He thinks it's cool and funny. It's going in the movie. I don't care. If it's cool and funny, it's in.
It is weird though that they're both aliens in this movie have, and a lot of other James Cameron movies have, tropey characters that are broad, but they feel offensive in Michael Bay films.
Well, the difference is that James Cameron is a smarter, funnier,
that's what I'm saying, yeah,
more normal person.
Yeah.
And
I say that because you started this podcast by saying he wants to be James Cameron, and you almost feel like he saw it and goes, I know how to do that.
But I think more than that, he sees, I know how to be James Cameron, which is, I don't take shit from anybody and I don't listen to anybody. If I feel it's right, it's going in the movie. Mm-hmm. And that is James Cameron. He just happens to be right.
Right.
He is a genius at this. Michael Bay is not a genius at this.
No.
But you see all of his personal... This is, I think, how it happens. You see all his personal instincts and preferences right there with no reserve.
It's like Quentin Tarantino is to our Boondock Saints fellow.
Totally.
All right.
Except anyway. Bay is better than... I mean...
I think
Michael Bay is just a deeply immature person.
Absolutely.
And you know, he...
And if you pay an immature person enough and tell them that they have carte blanche... They will triple, quadruple, quintuple down on that immaturity and display it for all to see.
Yep.
So they get in Alcatraz.
The hairdresser, by the way. That's the gay character.
Yes.
That's the quote-unquote gay character.
Yes.
Is the hairdresser.
Yes.
In San Francisco.
No, but and the thing about it, no jokes.
No jokes.
There's nothing he says is funny. He's just gay.
There's a thing that's supposed to be a joke that's also, I mean, a gay joke too, is in the elevator, he happens to ride down when Sean Connery escapes, and he goes, I don't care about any of this, I just want to know if you're happy with your haircut. That's written as a joke, but only as a gay joke.
I guess. Yep. Because only a gay
person
would only care about
haircut. Let me be clear, not funny, but written as a joke.
Yeah.
All right.
That all happens. So anyway, the team's in there, and in
also,
Alcatraz.
Throughout this, we don't know why Sean Connery was in prison still.
Oh, that's right.
Through all of this.
This is what we are saving as a spoiler.
Well, this is true, though, at this point in the film, we haven't been told either as an audience member.
That's right.
All right.
Right. We haven't.
That's important.
So the team has now entered Alcatraz because Sean Connery has rolled through the fire gauntlet and
opens the door
and says, welcome to the Rock.
Yeah.
in his voice.
Welcome to the Rock.
And they all go in.
You try it, Travis. How do you say it?
No, I can't. You know I can't.
Say it as Sean Connery.
Welcome to the Rock.
Well, weird.
Welcome. I don't do these things well. Rock. I should do an impression on every rock. Episode.
Yeah, one per episode.
Good. I'm into that.
That's great.
Anyway, they're in the Rock.
So I think, is the next set piece the Navy SEALs versus...
I absolutely think it is. Yeah, I think so the next too. Set piece is they find an area that has one of the... Chemical? Is that right? They find an area that has some sort of alarm that they've set up.
Yeah.
And that the psychopathic Marines have set up, and it's a motion detector, right? And the Navy SEALs that we are watching as the sort of heroes trigger it, and that triggers the Marines to come down, and there's a standoff, and there's a lot of shouting between General Ed Harris and
this
the
is
leader
a strange,
of the Navy SEALs.
This is a strange part where the wacky movie runs right into the serious movie.
Absolutely.
And it's a very odd sequence because suddenly it transitions so hard into melodrama, serious military melodrama. And so there's this standoff with Ed Harris's people, mercenary people, and these Navy SEALs, and they both don't want to shoot each other, but they both sort of feel so strongly convicted in their version of patriotism. And it winds up going sour, and they all shoot each other.
For the dumbest reason.
For really, someone drops a rock.
And yeah,
someone
drops
a rock, and
they
that's all, how
shoot,
it all, goes
they all shoot each other.
It's
and
so annoying.
Many of them die.
Yeah. And then you have this strange, again, Nicolas Cage, hero of a thousand faces, suddenly is called upon to weep, truly cry over the death of all these men
and fear.
Specifically one guy. Yeah, I guess it's fear, but it's also the music is telling us, as you pointed out, Spencer, or maybe Travis.
I think it was me.
That this scene, which is not in the key of the rest of the film, is played for deep sadness.
According to the music,
it's slow motion, heartstring pulling, melodramatic music, and the only character who really could possibly be feeling this way is Ed Harris.
Because you keep cutting to him and he keeps shouting, ceasefire,
yeah.
Ceasefire.
Begging them to stop. This
because
is not what he
remember,
wanted.
His whole point is to honor the memory of his dead soldiers, right. And give money to their families.
So he's
and
just,
now he's slaughtering other armed
yeah,
forces.
He's slaughtering too. Navy SEALs. So it's a very odd moment where the movie transitions back into the man's POV who we met in the cemetery, who
yeah.
we thought was patriotic. Odd, crazy,
strange.
Especially because what we sort of find out is that scene serves more, considering what the bulk of the movie is about, spending time on.
Right.
That scene serves more as almost a pragmatic contrivance to get rid of all of the Navy SEALs.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. So that. That Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage can spend the rest of the movie, the next hour of the movie together as a buddy team.
And the thing I would say is, and this is again, and I mean this basically in praise of Michael Bay. No, there's no half measures in this movie. No sequence goes to waste. So he does this scene, and he's like, "Well, we got to do the shit out of this scene." And he actually, for what that scene, for as stupid as that scene's purpose is, which you just identified, it's just we have to kill off these Navy SEALs because it now has to be a buddy movie. Mm-hmm. He roots it in the only point of view that could be as powerful as he needs a scene like that to be.
Yeah.
And so he's actually kind of smart to throw it back to Ed Harris. It's the only way to make that scene its mm-hmm. own thing
yeah.
rather than arbitrary. And that's a certain kind of skill. He knows how a movie's supposed to feel at any given second. It's
yeah.
just that
same
if
with
you
Nicolas
stand
Cage.
Back,
yeah.
it's just out of control. We do have to. We gotta rush this along. And
man.
Basically,
well,
yeah.
well, next. Why don't you?
I think the most important by far thing is the nature of Sean Connery's character.
Thank yeah. you. I was about to suggest you do that. That's perfect.
There's a conversation. Who has the conversation? Do you remember who has this conversation?
I don't remember how
about
this information
what his
comes
nature
out.
Is.
No.
Oh, no. There's just a couple.
Oh, it's two guys. The two guys.
A couple important guys.
Yeah, the guy with the mustache who's in Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
And some other dude are outside.
Is it like Major Smallmouth?
Yeah,
is
Major.
They're just having
some other guy.
Oh, important... oh, no, it's the West Wing guy. It's West Wing guy
and
William Forsythe.
Right. So they're having. They're couple
right.
of,
oh,
they're...
and then there's
yes.
a sweet piece of information
yes.
dropped here.
Yes.
Okay,
this
go
is the key of the whole movie.
There's a couple of really important guys who aren't important. into the movie, except for in this moment, who are standing outside of the situation, and they're having this conversation. There's a lot of great exposition in this film, by the way. We kept drawing attention to every moment
that exposition
is just happening. So in this is maybe the one that takes the proverbial cake. Is they're conversing about Sean Connery's character, Mr. Mason, and how he was originally from British intelligence.
SAS.
Ha-ha.
SAS. Yes. Hilarious. And that he was, man, I'm going to mess this up.
He was.
I only remember the part about what he had.
Yeah, he was running. Well, I think it's simple. He was running a spy mission to steal the files of J. Edgar Hoover.
Steal the files of J. Edgar Hoover, which included microfilm that detailed the information about the Roswell
alien landing.
Specifically, yes, these are the details. But the way they identify this microfilm is it contains every super secret America
every single
ever
one
had.
Including specifically these two points, the Roswell landing and who actually killed JFK.
And let me just say,
that's why Sean Connery. But then not only that,
the best line of the movie, maybe the where he says and we held him until he gave it up. And then he didn't give it up.
Yeah, he never did.
And he never did. And I turned to them both. I was like, to be clear, we held him till he gave it up, and he never did. What does that line mean?
No, and so their solution was put this guy in jail.
And erase his name and history from all memory.
I love the idea of trying to justify characters' behaviors and make them all good people. So you have to have a criminal, because he has to have been in Alcatraz, but make him a good criminal. So he was doing something good. And Ed Harris has to be a fucking psychopath to take over Alcatraz and threaten a city. What's the most noble reason you could give him? He's protecting the families of deceased soldiers.
It's true. It's very strange. And the movie gets into a lot of trouble with itself.
Hugely.
When it gets to the end and they're like, oh, we don't have any bad guys.
Yeah, there's no bad guys.
No one seems bad except the mercenaries, but they have a good enough reason, even though they're psychopaths.
Well, then they just
want the money.
Well, there's a stunning sequence where you see the movie realize that it's painted itself in a corner.
Yeah.
And there's just this bizarre 2 minutes where all of the other side mercenary characters go insane.
Yeah, they just do become psychopaths who want to drop bombs on San Francisco for arbitrary reasons.
And Ed Harris, you can see him being like, what's going on?
Yeah, what? Wait. Yeah. I wonder if that was an improv exercise. He wasn't told what was going to happen, because I think he's like, wait, what are you guys doing right now?
And it's just so that then this movie, which still has about 15 to 20 minutes left,
has some people they can kill.
Has someone to go kill and stuff a fucking super pellet down his mouth.
Oh my god. A pellet full of poison, you guys. So
shoves a super pellet full of poison down his mouth, and then he explodes like in another horror movie.
It's fucking rad.
Moments later, I think one of the last bad guys, quote unquote, is spending time with Nicolas Cage, and the final missile has been revealed.
Yeah.
And this is, I guess, I would like to think that this is a justification of the earlier thing where he likes British music or something, but he says, he says to the dude, do you know the song? Do you know Elton John, the song Rocket Man?
And the guy goes like, I don't listen to that soft shit.
I don't listen to that soft ass shit.
Yeah.
And
in case you guys couldn't tell, the guy is African American based on the character description. Right.
Yeah. And Nicolas Cage says, I was only asking you because you're him. You're the Rocket Man.
But before this, there's two beautiful angles of a rocket pointed directly at this guy.
Into his torso.
And they're very hilariously shot.
Yeah.
It's like, this rocket is going into this guy.
Did you guys get it?
Yeah. Shit right
also,
here.
Everyone realizes, except for the guy who stops in front of the rocket.
Yeah.
I don't understand why he doesn't put it together.
I know.
I do think that you're him is a beautiful line.
You're him. This is the only time in movie history where a lack of knowledge of Elton John has killed someone. Had he just understood, he could have taken a step to
the
right.
Oh.
Oh, Rocket Man?
Also, need to know Elton John to know when he says there's a song called Rocket Man?
Just move to the
what
left.
What might be about
Take
to happen.
Take one step to your left.
No, he gets hung up on that it's soft-ass shit.
Yeah, which means he does know it. Ironically, he knows Elton John. All right.
The rocket fires into his torso. Both of them fly into the bay. And then Nicolas Cage says something like, "What do you think about that shit?"
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
that's great.
Amazing. He is so funny.
He's amazing. So anyway, so then the very finale of the film, this is the last plot.
You
got
to tell this. It's
Wait,
your favorite
thing. Can I say
thing.
One thing before we get to that? I'm so sorry.
Sure.
So one of the other plots that's been going on is that in a last resort situation, the U.S. government has decided, rather than let these terrorists drop poison gas on San Francisco, we're going to blow up Alcatraz. So they've asked permission from the president to scramble five jet fighters. To come out, right? This is this subplot happening behind the scenes. That this is their B plot, which is if our SEAL team doesn't work, we're gonna bomb the shit out of Alcatraz to keep the gas contained. And so this is all happening. Nicolas Cage has shot the rocket man out of the window, and he's secured the island. But the fighters are still coming. So he comes out and has these two flares, and the symbol for abort attack is green smoke. He happens to have green flares for whatever reason. Don't worry about it. Full on platoons. It gets on his knees, puts his arms out, and alerts them. And they're like sending the fighters in, and it's tense, and there's 10 seconds left.
The fighters are about to kill all of the hostages
because there's
no radio signal.
They're going to kill everybody at this point because they don't know where anyone is, and they can't risk another threat to San Francisco. Someone actually says the line, it's an impossible decision, 1 million people or 81 hostages. And everyone in the room was like, what? That's not a hard decision.
And the person who says that line, the president of the United States of America.
So Donald Trump is having a huge problem making a math decision right now in the film. And then they see the flare, and they say, abort, abort, abort. And one pilot goes, I already dropped mine. That actually
he just
happens.
Jumped the gun a little
he
bit.
Jumped the gun and dropped a huge bomb on Alcatraz.
Which, again,
it misses.
Through no action of the heroes, misses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the way the movie ends. So here's what I want to say about that now, before we now get to the very, very ending. I have a theory about how to watch Michael Bay movies. And this is the theory that I want to apply should we ever pull one.
Drunk
again.
Or with friends?
Or if I go watch, any of the Transformers films or whatever, is you're agreeing to a contract, which is I'm not going to have any idea how long this entire movie is, but for whatever duration it is and however long that feels, you have to click into how long is each mini episode going to last. Mm-hmm. And you have to learn to turn on and turn off and then turn on and turn off again and start and stop and start and stop over and over and over again. In The Rock, I would say that happens 50 times.
Yeah.
And my theory is Transformers 5, it happens 5,000 times.
Mm.
And that
the preview certainly makes it look that way.
And I think they're onto something here. And I don't know if it necessarily makes it good or enjoyable, but if you can find that groove of every 10 seconds, every 1 minute, I'm going to start over and just enjoy this one thing, this little portrait of a story or this little sliver of a thing, an idea, a tone. I wonder if that's where the people who defend Michael Bay find themselves and how they find themselves accessing the movies. Because I was just listening to you tell that story, and I was like, that scene with the planes is pretty awesome. He's doing some cool like posing against explosions, and it's pretty exciting that they accidentally drop a bomb. But nothing that happened before means anything, and nothing that happens after means anything for that sequence.
Nope.
But it's shot as if it did. It's shot as if it matters.
Very, very dramatic.
Yeah. And so, that that's my new thing. That's my new approach to Michael Bay. Travis has just abandoned the show.
Bag.
Oh, it's right here. Didn't I bring it?
Is this the time where you...
Maybe not. Maybe
is this the time where you do one of two things? You reveal the very last moments of The Rock, or you bring up that thing that you said you had to bring up about...
I'll do both.
Okay.
So the ending of the movie, of course, maybe you can figure it out, is that you catch up with Nicolas Cage and his girlfriend. Everybody is safe. Sean Connery has slipped him in a dress for a church in New Mexico or something. And...
Which
Nicolas
is
Cage,
Kansas.
In Kansas. And Nicolas Cage goes there dressed like H.I. McDonough from Raising Arizona. And this shot is you see him like comedy running out of the church.
Yeah.
With a priest chasing him.
With a priest chasing him, calling him a thief. And Nicolas Cage going, I'm sorry. And then he jumps in a shitty beat up Volvo.
That says just married on
says,
the back.
Just married.
It's fucking Raising
it's
Arizona.
Straight up Raising yeah. Arizona. And then he's looking at, it's like the end of a Coen Brothers movie. He's looking, an early one. He's looking at the microfilm and he goes, honey, do you want to know who killed JFK?
That's the
end
of the movie.
End of The Rock.
That's the end.
It's that's the way The
amazing.
Rock ends.
And that sequence that you just mentioned lasts 20 seconds.
It's so short.
I love it.
It is awesome.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
So that's how the movie ends. You've made it all the way through. Mostly what we did was tell you the story of The Rock.
Here's well, what let I, me tell you
just
something.
Watch it and have as much fun as we did.
We had a great time.
Yeah, it's the greatest. It's the greatest. Don't listen to me in the intro. Listen to me now in the outro.
We, you know what? We've changed hearts and minds today, Spencer.
I think so.
Well done. Here's what I was... Well, the movie did, but also us.
Here's what I was going to say when I asked Travis very seriously to remind me of something, and Spencer just reminded me of that thing. We were having a conversation with a friend of mine named Gio Benedetti.
Hey, Gio.
He was in our house. And we had an idea
Gio,
for a
I
show.
Miss you already.
We had an idea for a show. Do you remember the idea that we
yeah,
had?
Yeah, does your favorite song suck?
Don't you think Spencer should do a little... Like, here's the proposal, Spencer. Okay. We had an idea for a show called Does Your Favorite Song Suck? And it would be a spinoff of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?
We would sponsor it to our 50 listeners.
And what I think we should do is create a sub-show within this show to begin, like The Simpsons on the Tracy Ullman Show, uh-huh, for instance, uh-huh, where we have another running list going and we throw you a song and you give us like a 5 or 10 minute or whatever thing on that song from this 80s, 90s era. Do you think you want to do that once in a while?
I am very, very intrigued by this idea.
Well, it's in a way it's better than the film idea, is that it's the nostalgia of the film. Can you separate that from the musicality and excellence in songwriting of the film?
It's hard for me to say on microphone that I will 100% do this.
Well, that's why we're asking you
we'll,
now.
We'll
think,
talk
right?
it through.
I see what,
but,
no, I
but
see
I
what
will
Kalen's
say,
done here.
But
so
I will
smart.
Say it sounds like a really fun idea.
So,
I
yes.
think it's
going to
be
you're
very
say yes
fun
to it.
Idea. And it, we'll
this
make
goes
you
out
do
live.
It.
Obviously, we can't edit
we're gonna,
this. So.
There's no, there's no
yeah,
editing
this
on this
live.
Recording.
It's being, no it's being published right now to the internet. This is how this happens.
I'll tell you more about it after this idea. And I think we want to craft it and figure out what that idea might actually look like. But I think it would be so fun, and you are so good at it. And I wouldn't have raised this except that we were having this intense conversation about Belle Biv DeVoe and the New Edition.
That
and,
did
like,
come up earlier.
That came up. And I was like, this is the guy. He knows all this shit. He knows these songs. He has interesting and smart things to say. It would be so fun.
Can we be your first guest on your podcast? I want to volunteer to be on
beyond
the
yes portion.
Well,
of
obviously,
I don't,
he's
I don't
do
have
it.
A recording area or microphones.
Please tell the listeners what we're recording on right now. This costs $30 total.
Yeah, I guess so. Right. Okay.
Listen, we'll come on the podcast. We'll draw a song out of our bag.
I love it.
Speaking of, here's our bag, which I did run out of the room to grab.
This is really exciting for me. I can hear the theme music by Goodbye the Band.
That's right. That's
playing right now.
Who's. The only other rival for Spencer's genius is potentially John Aquadro.
My favorite musician.
Oh, excellent. Two questions, Spencer Owen. One, is there anything you want to plug or ways people can follow
oh,
you
gosh.
Or things people should buy or see?
I have a website called thespenserowen.com, and then I have a Bandcamp page, spenserowen.bandcamp.com. I'm a musician, as Kalen mentioned.
We didn't even say this entire time. Watching The Rock and your biography that Spencer lives in San Francisco.
I live in Oakland, but yes, I live in the Bay Area. And I did notice the part, and I'm sure you noticed the part too, where the missile was flying right towards quote-unquote Oakland because there's a football game happening, and the football stadium is basically on a fake version of Treasure Island. Which is totally. So weirdly nonsensical. It's just like a CGI shot they wanted to put in there for looks.
Incredible.
Anyway, I live in the Bay Area, and my band, Spencer Owen Timeshare, plays all the time in the Bay Area, like a few times a year minimum. So definitely.
I know of at least one of our listeners who lives in Oakland, Steve Westall. So Steve, go see Spencer Owen.
I publish, you know, a mailing list. I don't know. Go to my website. Go Google my name and musician, and you'll find
Tell
all my
website
music.
One more time.
Spencer Owen, thespenserowen.com or spenserowen.bandcamp.com. All the albums that I want you to hear are on spenserowen.bandcamp.com.
Please, but there
please
are
check
more.
Them out. Yeah, please
there
check
are
them
more.
Out. Question two: is there any other beef you want to take up from previous episodes?
No, I don't think there's real beef. I loved Spaceballs as a kid,
yeah.
But I don't want to see it again.
I felt like we got somewhere. What was the episode where we were saying, oh, it's on Sandlot. I really felt like we broke new ground when we said, don't listen to this as not a critique of the movie you watched when you were a kid.
Yeah.
But as the unfortunate film you would watch now.
And
avoid that movie.
Well, I like the idea that this podcast is about protecting nostalgia.
Yes.
That's a whole new angle on it, yes. Which is, you know what, your nostalgia is great. Hold on to it. Don't
you
spoil it.
You weren't wrong. You just, you would not
you
have,
were different.
Yeah.
Or in the case of The Rock, invent nostalgia for me. Because I never saw it, and now I see it, and it was great.
Killer. All right, so this is our bag. You can reach in and pull a movie.
I would recommend going in deep, as
go
far
deep.
As you can go.
Get
find
to
something
the white
weird.
Meat. Get to the white meat.
Not hard to do.
Yeah,
it's can a, just reach in.
Well, it's a really expensive looking bag. You know.
Thank you, Spencer, for coming
thanks for
on
doing
the show.
It's been such a pleasure.
Excellent.
It was everything I hoped.
I'm so glad to hear that. Next week, you will not be watching, but we will be watching on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?
Before you say it, is this one you're happy to miss or sad to miss?
It's just one I've never seen.
Okay, go on.
I've never seen it.
What is it?
And it's called Cruel Intentions.
Wow!
I'm into that.
Yeah, I'm into it too.
A little genre shift. I'll take it. And a little bit of a new one.
More 90s.
All right. Well, join us next week to see if Cruel Intentions sucks on
Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?